a landlord who was told, or who had told their tenant that they needed to do major renovations, and because of that, they requested that their tenant have a $300 rent increase. And there was a concerted effort and campaign, and this is something that actually ended up being reversed, but the, I guess, way it did is pretty interesting. So let's take a listen to that piece.
Montreal's Autonomous Tenants Union saw a major victory as a pair of tenants living at the corner of Saint-Denis and Roy Streets were able to avoid a rent increase of almost 20% thanks to a campaign of direct action that saw union members picket outside the landlord's cafe and store, conveniently located right next door. Lior Maharjan is one of the tenants who faced an almost $300 a month rent hike. She tells CKUT that she took action because the alternative was to go to the housing tribunal, which, because of the work her landlord did on the building, would likely have approved the increase. Because of the direct action, however, now she won't pay any additional rent and will only take on the costs of hydro. We speak about her experience and what other tenants facing rising rents can learn from her victory. Here's our conversation. Let's start at that moment when you get this major rent increase notice. Tell me about that moment. Tell me about how you felt.
Well, it was a big number to see on the proposal sheet. We knew that that was more than we can afford. We've seen big rent increases, but by far the largest that we've seen with our landlord. And so we knew that we were going to reject it. We knew that that would lead most likely into negotiations, and that's what we proposed at that point. It's such a high number that even to start from there, like, you know, we were in the kind of $200 to $300 range, you know, like that 20% is close to $300. And at that time, we had very little ways to fight it. So we were trying to level with him in that ballpark of $200 to $300, which is a lot to take on. Despite anticipating that there would be a really large increase, there was nothing that was preparing us for the number that came on that sheet. It started to feel more and more like we were being squeezed out of our apartment. And in all honesty, it's not the first time that our landlord tried to get us out. So it's been part of a continuous battle. But this really was kind of beyond what we could take.
And then this is where SLAM comes in, the union effort comes in, and you say, okay, we're not going to be able to fight this through the towel, through the housing tribunal. We're going to have to do direct action. Tell me about how and when that all came together.
Yeah, well, that is ultimately SLAM's mission, is organizing through collective action, direct action. And so it was honestly something that we were pretty ready to jump on. We expected the rent increase. It was hard to sit with even when it came in despite that. But we always had this idea of, like, you know, if it gets to that point, if he tries to evict us another way, whatever it might be, we knew that it is perfectly within our rights to say, this is what our landlord is doing. This is how our landlord is related to this business. We're on the street with flyers and free coffee, and we'll fix your bike too if you got one. So, you know, like, it was just kind of this very simple action to try and appeal to the public.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit more about the action.
Yeah.
What exactly did you guys do?
Well, you know, so on a broad level, we were just trying to put a face to the crisis. But on the ground, we gathered our members together. It was, you know, classic picket line. We had our signs, you know, just peacefully outside of the business. We weren't stopping anyone from going in, but definitely people were discouraged.
And this is the landlord's son's business that is right next door, in the building next door to yours.
Yes, exactly. The landlord owns both of the buildings. Him and his son operate as business partners, both when it comes to landlord responsibilities. They've both been owners of the cafe in the past. The landlord no longer is, but his history with it shows that they're very clearly associated. Most landlords experience that enterprise completely separate from the rest of their lives. It's not really a public-facing thing. In our case, our landlord has a holdings company where he owns at least five buildings, but that's all relatively private information. It's hard to access that. We only know of one other building address that he owns. All we were doing was saying exactly what was happening out loud, which landlords are not used to having to contend with the fact that, oh, these actions are now being associated with me directly. And yes, in this case, the fact that there's a business where there is, you know, they're serving clientele in the neighborhood. But having that kind of target really helped it. I'll say in our landlord's words, when we ended up negotiating with him in person, because that's what this action was able to accomplish for us, was he came back to the negotiating table.
And you ended up negotiating no rent increase at all, right? Mm-hmm. You're not going to be paying this $280 roughly dollar mm-hmm. a month increase. You're just going to be taking on your own hydro costs, which he mm-hmm. covered before. How did that all go down?
Yeah, in past rent increases, it was something that we had used as a negotiating chip to say, you know, we could take on hydro instead of such a big rent increase, especially because, as I said, if you raise the rent by, let's say, $100 this year, and then you get a 10% increase next year, that alone is just $10 of an increase on top of the rest of your rent. So taking on the hydro is advantageous in that it slowly stops that accumulation rate. And it was especially beneficial this year because the landlord just changed the exterior, like the doors and the windows for the balcony. So
you're going to be paying a lot less.
A lot less. So roughly when it comes to dollar amounts, that's about like an $85 a month on equalization compared to the $285 that he was going for, which is significant enough. You know, it's still a big increase. It's still like a lot to have to take. And I'll be honest, there was like even feelings within the union of like, well, can we get more? But this is undeniably a huge success because really, again, he could have gotten easily 220, 230 upwards of there at the tribunal, maybe more. We didn't know what he was going to show up with that he didn't show us already, you know?
Yeah, because, you know, on the documents that he submitted with this fixation of rent application to the tribunal, you know, this is listing like around $350,000 worth of work for the previous year. Mm-hmm. And you've talked about how, you know, if you do go to the TAL as a tenant up against this, you're never going to win mm-hmm. because the TAL's rent fixation formula, which is maybe going to change because of certain proposals by the CAC government, but, you know, whether it's the current formula or the future formula, in either case, it's going to say, well, you as a landlord should be able to pass along that work to mm-hmm. tenants. Thinking about that, I can imagine him saying, like, well, I had a fair case. I had a fair case, and I couldn't fairly pass mm-hmm. along these expenses to my tenant. As the tenant, what do you say to landlords like him and the people who would defend the current system, the status quo mm-hmm. at the TAL?
Yeah. Well, first simple answer, just because you're allowed to do something doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do. When we were negotiating with the landlord, he was making a bit of, the argument of we make our own choices. He was talking about how he made his wealth in his life. And I had to point out at that moment of saying, well, this is as much a choice, you know, to raise the rent. And the question that we laid on the table was, what difference does this make for you in your life? At that point, we were asking for a 4% increase versus what he was offering was 10%. That's where we were at about a week ago in negotiations. And it was that the 6% we asked in his daily life, he said there was nothing really that it would affect. Maybe it would cover more of his insurance. But he made it clear that for him, this was just something he was tired of having to deal with, that he'd rather even sell the building maybe. Where for us, you know, it's not that small of a thing. Like the way it affects our daily lives, the groceries we buy, the work we take on, whether we're looking at other places to move, that's really kind of the power dynamic that we're talking about here, right? It's the people who are profiting off of livelihoods, and there's the people whose livelihoods are being profited off of. So there's that aspect of it. When it comes to the tribunal system specifically, I mean, I think at just a glance, it's, you know, set up by our MNAs at the Assemblée Nationale, many of whom, the majority of whom are landowners, many of those who are landlords themselves. This new rent increase formula that Minister Duranceau has brought out adds in the cost of living index, because I guess we should, because life is more expensive, we should pay more as we're already paying more for everything else. And again, that makes rents more expensive, which makes life more expensive. And so that index rises, and all, it's a self-fulfilling system that way. It just feeds off of itself. Similarly with the way that plays into property values and all of the stuff, we just saw that Montreal has now just gone above $1 million on average for the average home in the city. It's a 43%, I believe, increase since 2020. This is drastic stuff, you know, and even like offering a 4% increase, which we were doing at that point in negotiations, that would have been a huge increase in 2019, 2018. We were seeing like 1.5, 1.7, you know, 1.9. This is, so the situation that we're finding ourselves in isn't just some like, oh, how did we end up here? The CAC has not alleviated the issue. They haven't done much to stop it. And if anything, they've done a lot to exacerbate it. We've lost lease transfers. We're seeing these rent increases. And at this point, we're saying, when does it stop?
And so what's your message to future tenants? Because, you know, as we've discussed, it can be difficult to find yourself in a situation whether you're getting this massive rent increase that you guys were seeing initially, mm-hmm. or just a notice that is, you know, 6%, which is roughly what many people got this year mm-hmm. if they got, you know, the number that the TAL put out. I believe it was 5.9. You know, many tenants would potentially get more than 6%. We're hearing all kinds of stories. You know, for people who are sort of looking at what the options are and not finding ways within the formal systems like the TAL to go up against major rent increases, what's your message from the victory that you had with SLAM?
Well, it definitely didn't feel like we had much behind us. I'll say it hasn't been an easy process by any mean. The stuff that's tough to do is often the stuff that's worth doing, though. I do stand by that. And I think, you know, thinking outside of the box and really questioning the power of compassion, you know, the fact that we are a majority when it comes to people having to pay their rents. Also say that joining a union is just one simple way to kind of add your own personal power into the pool and then to have that, you know, backing you as well. You know, there's many different ways that that we can do this, but just gathering the information, getting to know your neighbors, it's the starting point. And honestly, if I were to give advice to me circa, you know, 2021 when I moved into this place, I'd say, you know, your neighbors are cool. You get along. It's chill. Get to know them better. You know, like have this conversation. Ask if they're planning on leaving at the end of the lease cycle. You know, we knew each other's rents. We would talk about rent increases. It was already kind of the seeds were there. But had we kind of done this work that the union really promotes back then, we might be in a situation where the other units would have also not been turned into Airbnbs, you know, and that's of benefit to all of us trying to find affordable housing in the city.
Thank you so much for coming on CKUT. I appreciate you sharing your story.
Oh, a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we're back live on CKUT. You just heard my interview with Lior Maharjan, a member of the Montreal Autonomous Tenants Union, who just gained a major victory by not having to take on an almost 20% rent increase. When reached by CKUT, her landlord, Mario Sancier, said in a statement that he withdrew the planned rent increase because of what he describes as the tenant's blackmail. He also underlines that the work he did on the building was necessary and perfectly legal under the Housing Tribunal's formula to give that kind of an increase. And he says he comped 25% of Lior and her partner's rent while it was ongoing. For CKUT, I'm Jules Bujal with the Local Journalism Initiative, Montreal.
Once again, thank you to Jules Bujal for that piece on a single Montreal tenant who faced a major rent hike, but a story that I think exemplifies something that a lot of renters, whether it be in Montreal, whether it be in Vancouver, whether it be in Burnaby, have had to go through or will have to go through at some point. So thank you again to CKUT and Jules Bujal for that piece. Before we get into the next talk segment of the hour here on Speak Up, got some more local jazz for you. This is John Bentley with Down in the Depths. Thank you. Once again, that was Down in the Depths with John Bentley. You're listening to Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. This has been your host, Danny Nesvedarani. And I think about time is now for a bird note.
This is Bird Note. The Tower of London has a long and notorious history. It has been the site of murderous political intrigue and famous beheadings, a place to lock up prisoners or the crown jewels. And for more than 300 years, the Tower of London has also been home to a flock of pampered ravens. Legend has it that in 1666, the time of the Great Fire of London, ravens were vilified as scavengers of the dead. When asked to rid London of all ravens, including those in the tower, King Charles II consulted his soothsayer, who foretold that the tower would crumble, and the monarchy with it, if the ravens were ever killed. The ravens would live, the king proclaimed, and be given the royal treatment for the good of England. At least that's one version of the tale. The curious corvids have inspired several origin stories over the centuries, and we may never know which, if any, are true. But to this day, a raven master from the Yeoman Warders cares for no fewer than 6 ravens in the Tower of London. They're given ample food, comfy quarters, and private burials in the moat near Traitor's Gate. The ravens live out their lives happily in the tower. More than can be said for Anne Boleyn, Thomas More, or Sir Walter Raleigh. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Support for Bird Note is provided by Charlie and Carrie Kale and generous listeners around the world.
And now for a CJSF Heritage Minute. During the 80s and the 90s, CJSF would come into its own as a serious platform for independent artists and a forum for people to express ideas not present in the mainstream media. Summer 2002, CJSF receives a license from the Canadian Radio Telecommunications Commission to broadcast over the FM airwaves. February 13th, 2003, 7 p.m. CJSF goes on air at 90.1 FM, and we've been changing the sound of radio in Burnaby ever since.
Thank you all for listening to that CJSF Heritage Minute. We are at the very end of the hour, and we have one last piece to play for all of you. This one is coming from myself again. This is an interview I did a couple weeks back with an organization based in Vancouver by the name of Vision Zero, a new billboard they put out, and their goal to bring down any sort of traffic-related injuries or deaths down to zero. This is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Vision Zero Vancouver is a local nonprofit organization that is advocating for one very specific thing: zero deaths and serious injuries on Metro Vancouver streets. An ambitious goal, but one that Vision Zero is continuing to fight for through providing educational resources, advocating for specific policy changes, and public campaigns, including a new Vision Zero public billboard, which aims to raise awareness on unsafe road conditions within Vancouver that are often considered normal. CJSF reached out to Vision Zero for more information on this billboard campaign and what the organization hopes it's able to achieve. We were able to speak with Dylan Pereira, an advocacy coordinator for Vision Zero, on the campaign and the organization's overall objectives.
This is a really critical priority, and that far too many people are injured and die for entirely preventable reasons on roads all across Canada and North America, but particularly here in Metro Vancouver. And yeah, our focus is advocating for measures to help try to make Vision Zero a reality. We tend to place a particular emphasis on more kind of systematic measures. You will see kind of like other sort of traffic safety or awareness campaigns that will be like, hey, pay more attention while you're driving, or, you know, things about like, hey, if you're a pedestrian or a cyclist, you should wear brightly colored clothes so that drivers can see you. And it's not that those things can't be useful, But I think we really want to kind of tackle this from the top down and tackle these kind of like bigger reasons related to like policy and road design.
We then asked Pereira to further explain the billboard, which reads, "Smoking tables next to non-smoking tables used to be normal too. Join us in fighting for safer streets."
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I guess just for anyone listening who hasn't seen our billboard, it's a picture of a large transport truck and a really narrow painted bike lane with like a child riding a bike. And yeah, this should not be normal. It's extremely dangerous. And it's honestly pretty wild to us that this is something that we're kind of expected to accept as normal. And, you know, I mean, just in the same way that in the past, people would say, oh, you're in the smoking section, or if you're not in the smoking section, you're going to be protected from secondhand smoke. That's just absolutely not true. And I mean, I think kind of in a similar way, having like a thin line painted on a road is certainly not doing anything to protect anyone, any road user. I mean, particularly people like children. But yeah, we just want to really highlight that this is really kind of absurd, and this is really wild that this exists. And just because it's normal now, we sort of envision a future where this is no longer normal, and where people look back on things like this and, you know, they're able to see that this is kind of just as strange or just as unsafe as things like smoking sections in restaurants. So
later on, we asked what the community response and engagement has been with this billboard campaign.
Yeah, for the community response, though, it's generally been pretty positive. I feel like we've been getting quite a bit of traction on social media. We've had a few different media outlets reach out to us for comments and interviews about this. I feel like some people are maybe a little bit confused. We had one person in the comments on a social media post saying that bike lanes are the smoking tables and they want to get rid of the bike lanes. So not everybody's going to get it, and that's okay. But I think we also kind of enjoy that we are sort of sparking some conversation. It's kind of cool that we were able to do something that does make people stop and think a little bit. And yeah, we want to spark a conversation and kind of see what this brings up for people.
Lastly, we asked Dylan Pereira what sort of change Vision Zero is hoping to affect within the coming months.
We have a number of campaigns ongoing and a bunch more coming up. And yeah, really a lot of what we do is about trying to, I mean, build awareness in the public, but then to kind of get the public to direct that towards, you know, emailing your counselors, calling your counselors, telling them about your priorities, and when election time comes around, also voting with those priorities in mind.
Once again, that was our interview with Dylan Pereira, an advocacy coordinator for Vision Zero Vancouver, on the organization's new billboard campaign, which promotes the idea of denormalizing unsafe road conditions. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. It is now, again, Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, and we have reached the very end of the hour. Coming up right next is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, so make sure you stay tuned for that. Got a great day of programming coming up.